entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Hello there, and a good Sunday morning to you on this 18th day of the month of August. It is the best of Downtown. Rich Kimble and Kerry Haskell here. Brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Our weekly look back at some favorite conversations from recent days, and three very good ones for you, including the great actor and musician Michael McKean, and two talented writers, Josh Karp and Nicholas Parisi. We talk about a lot of different subjects this morning. Let's get it underway, though, a wide-ranging discussion with writer Josh Karp, focusing largely, though, on Orson Welles. He's the author of the book Orson Welles' Last Movie. Here's Josh Karp on Downtown.
Hey, Rich, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I meant to ask you this the first time you were on because you wrote about your unique training methods. How's your golf game?
not that. I was just on vacation and played a couple times, and I'm doing all right. I care less about how I play, so I play a little bit better, not caring so much, kind of trying to enjoy what I'm doing rather than thinking I'm about to go out and win the Masters.
But consistently straight down the middle, right?
Always.
I wanted to talk with you a lot more this time around about Orson Welles. We touched on him the first time you were on with us, and he's one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. But I wonder, do you think there's a danger? For years, Citizen Kane was always, in whatever list came out, it was always at the top of the list as the greatest film of all time. And recent years, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's The Godfather, and there are other possibilities. Is there a danger of people maybe forgetting Kane, or at least forgetting the incredible innovations that were a part of that film?
Oh, absolutely. When I was working on the book, I was teaching journalism at Northwestern, and I was, doing some research one day and before class, and one of my students came in and they said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm, doing some research on this book and what's it about? And I said, oh, it's about Orson Welles. And we ran through, I was like, Citizen Kane, no. Everything, you would identify Orson Welles by until we got to the pee commercial where he goes totally crazy, during the radio and yells at the guy who's telling him what to do. So, really, if you're under, I would say maybe 40, he's really like he's the pee guy or he's the drunk guy on the Parmesan commercials. But so, there is a danger. That a movie like that and a talent like his gets forgotten over the course of time.
I worry too. I hear this a lot from young people. Well, mostly my students, if I show something in black and white in class, I get that immediate eye roll from some kids. Ah, it's black and white. Well, I want to watch this. And I try to explain to them, but it often falls on deaf ears.
Yeah. I think, it's funny. I love black and white films, and I have four kids, and I've kind of tried to get them to watch them. And, sometimes it really works, but it's got to be like the Marx Brothers, or It's a Wonderful Life or something like that. But otherwise, they just completely tune out. And I think that it's such a terrible problem because there's so many great, great films made before color that are better, than so many color films. I saw Casablanca in an actual movie theater about a year ago, and it's just unbelievable when you see a movie like that shown the way it was meant to be shown.
If we assume that Citizen Kane is Welles' greatest film, what to you would be number two on that list?
Well, my favorite film of his other than that is The Lady from Shanghai. Mm. It's such a weird movie. Somebody said it was the weirdest great movie or the greatest weird movie ever made. and it's just such a fun movie to watch. And I enjoy his performance in it, and it's so unbelievably interesting. Everybody talks about it, but the mirror scene at the end is an amazing scene, and kind of watching that over and over when I was working on the book and trying to discern how Welles was able to do it was, you know, that was really fun. I mean, he was such a, he was a guy who just absolutely always had to kind of up his degree of difficulty on everything he did. And that to me, you know, it was really interesting. It was like making a movie wasn't enough of a challenge for him. He had to do something nobody else had ever done every time, you know, he came to bat.
One of my favorites, and it's amazing to me how many people have never seen it. I've probably seen it a dozen times. I absolutely love F for Fake.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a great, and that's a very, you know, innovative innovative film. And it was, you know, it was a film he actually, I don't know if you know, but he took it over kind of midway through from another director and turned it into something completely different than what it had been intended to be. But it was great because it was, you know, this movie all about, you know, a forger and what's real and what's not. And it was very much in keeping with Wells' persona and where he was going, you know, with his films at the time.
Of the acting gigs that he took where he wasn't the director, what are a couple that stand out for you along the way? And there were so many great ones.
You know, probably the one that everybody says, but I'll say it, is The Third Man. He's just amazing in that. He's, you know, everything. One thing about him is he was just somebody who was such a presence, even before he became the gigantic Orson Welles, even when he was a young man. He's just somebody who, when he walks on screen in any film, it becomes, you know, you can't take your eyes off of him. He's just this kind of, you know, he's not, the, you know, the world's, you know, best looking guy, not the world's most charismatic guy or whatever, but he has huge, you know, energy. So in The Third Man, you know, he just really, it's one of the roles he actually kind of underplays a little bit. Instead of being like Orson Welles, you know, he's just kind of an act, you know, he's being an actor in it. So that's the one I like most.
And I don't think it's great acting necessarily, but another film where I can't take my eyes off him when he's on screen is Catch 22.
Oh, sure. And, you know, he apparently when he was making that film, Mike Nichols was just absolutely terrified to have him on the set. I mean, he, like, you know, that when they cast him, he was like, are you kidding me? Did I have to direct Orson Welles? And I think there are a couple of good stories about him, you know, not wanting to come out of his trailer to direct Orson when Orson arrived on the set because, you know, not only was he, you know, this larger-than-life filmmaker, he was such a presence, and he was the kind of person who, you know, depending on his mood, tell you exactly how everything ought to be done.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown, the author of Orson Welles' last movie, the great documentary They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, chronicling the making, the journey, the epic journey of completing The Other Side of the Wind. The character of Jake Hannaford is very interesting. As you explain in the book, it's hard to pin down who he is, certainly an amalgam of a lot of people that Welles encountered along the way, and maybe a glance in the mirror as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's John Ford, he's John Huston, he's, you know, all the kind of manly directors when directors were figures. You know, you don't think of, you know, you don't hear anything about Steven Soderbergh's fascinating life, you know, away from making films, but with those guys, I mean, you know, their persona off screen was as big as the kind of the films they made, you know, and they were these hard drinking, hell raising, you know, geniuses. And so, you know, I always thought that Welles kind of used that persona, and actually casting Huston in the role did it perfectly, as kind of a way of telling his own story without it looking autobiographical. You know, at one point he and Huston sat down, and just the idea of the two of them being together was actually, when I was thinking about writing a book, I was like, oh God, when am I ever going to get to write about two guys like that? You know, I mean, really, I mean, you know, you're talking, people aren't like that. They don't make people like that anymore. You know, the whole kind of just everything about them is so outsized. And, but they were sitting there and, you know, Huston said, wow, what the hell is this film about anyway? And Orson said something like, you know, it's about a bastard director who destroys everybody's lives. And then he paused, you know, did a big Orson pause, and he said, it's about us, John. you know, so I think, you know, he always denied that it was his, you know, that it was autobiographical, but I think he had a great way of pretending it wasn't because he cast John Huston, whose persona was so opposite of Orson's. You know, Orson was not, you know, even though he was a big cigar-smoking, you know, hard-drinking guy, he wasn't, you know, somebody who was, you know, seemed like his whole life was trying to kill himself, like, you know, like Huston's was, but yet always living despite the odds. He was a little bit less adventuresome as a human being off screen.
One of the most famous characters in the story of the making of The Other Side of the Wind is Gary Graver, who essentially talked himself into a job that really became a lifetime job.
Yeah, you know, that that to me, before I started the book, was one of the most fascinating things. I mean, you know, at the time Wells started making the film in 1970, you know, there was this huge kind of, like, Roger Corman's movies, these, you know, horror movies and these biker movies and these exploitation movies. That was like a film school. If people would go to work for Corman and they would learn how to make a movie, and Corman would pay them nothing, but he'd let them have total control over making the picture. And that's where a lot of people got their training, including Peter Bogdanovich. I think Ron Howard made films for him. And Gary was a cinematographer in that world. And he really just worshipped Orson Welles. And so the story, and this was kind of just too good to even have in a book, was that he was with his wife at Schwab's drugstore one afternoon. He picked up Variety, and he looked, and there was an Army Archer little, you know, one of those ... columns about who's seen here and there, that Orson Welles in town planning to make his film The Other Side of the Wind. And he goes, where would Orson Welles be staying if he was here? And he calls the Beverly, he calls a couple places, and they call the Beverly Hills Hotel. And he says, Orson Welles, please. And the call goes through. And all of a sudden, you know, he doesn't just have Orson Welles on the other end of the line. He has, like, Orson Welles, you know, he's got the voice and everything. And he says, you know, who is this? And he says, my name's Gary Graver. I'm a cameraman. I'd love to work with you. And Orson kind of blows him off and says, you know, God, give me your phone number. Maybe I'll call you sometime. Click. And so Gary's like, oh, I've blown my big shot. And he and his wife go home, and they're pulling into their driveway in Laurel Canyon, and he hears the phone ringing inside, and he just instinctively knows, and he runs in the house, and he says, he picks it up, and he goes, Gary, it's Orson. He says, you've got to get down to the Beverly Hills Hotel right away. And he gets in his car, and he speeds away, and that really is the rest of his life. He spends working for Orson, trying to get The Other Side of the Wind made, and, you know, doing, you know, shooting porn films on the side to make a living. But I can't think of another relationship like theirs, because he gave his life to Orson Welles, and he gave his life to The Other Side of the Wind.
And then even got Welles to help out with one of his pornographic films.
Yeah, that was, that was really funny. I found myself having possibly the weirdest conversation of my entire career with Joe McBride, who's a great writer, who was very helpful to me, and he had written several books about Welles. And there's a porn movie called 3 AM, starring a woman named Georgina Spelvin, and who I guess was a big porn star in the mid-70s. And the story was that Gary, you know, always said yes to Orson, and always, you know, if Orson needed him, he'd run. And he lost a couple marriages because of that, and he was always, you know, working 24 hours a day for Orson and then trying to earn a living on the side. And so finally, this one time, he stood his ground, and he said, Orson, I cannot come back to work until I finish editing this film 3 a.m. And Orson says, okay, what can I do to help you? And so he goes over to Gary's house, and they're editing the film, and Orson says, you know, he's trying to cut together different scenes, and he goes, well, I'll cut together that scene. And it is a scene in a shower, involving two women, and Joe McBride had reported it as being a certain one kind of pornographic act, and I realized that it was a lesbian, you know, scene, and he and I are on the phone discussing whether this is a lesbian scene or a solo scene. It was like and I'm like, this is really the weirdest thing I'm ever going to do in my life. But yeah, so Orson Welles, if you watch 3 a.m., there is a scene that Welles edited, and he did it in like real Welles fashion, which I always love. it kind of has all these like Wellesian flourishes in the editing and strange angles and all that. And I always, you know, think it's so great that when asked to do something just to get it done, he couldn't do it anyway, but in the Orson Welles manner.
I love it. We're going to be talking with Peter Bogdanovich next week. And of course, he and Welles had a complicated relationship, and that kind of made its way to the screen and Other Side of the Wind, with Bogdanovich playing one character and then Rich Little, at least for a while, sort of playing Bogdanovich.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, whenever I have to sum up the story of that film in, you know, a paragraph, I always say, you know, Welles started shooting it in 1970. And at the time, Bogdanovich was a young director, but he was basically a journalist. And he was writing a book about Welles. And he, in the film, in 1970, plays a guy who's writing a book about the main character, and a film journalist. And the character is a lot like Peter. Peter loves to do celebrity impressions. The guy did impressions, you know, and all of this stuff. And so then Bogdanovich goes off and makes like three hit films in a row. He makes The Last Picture Show. He makes Paper Moon, and he makes What's Up, Doc? And there is a character that Welles adds at one point that is a protege of the main character who likes to do impressions and who has made three hit films in a row and is the hottest young director in Hollywood, which is exactly what Peter was at the time. And inexplicably, I mean, I guess because the character likes to do impressions, he hires Rich Little, which... I just always love that idea. And Rich Little, I think, was completely baffled by the entire experience of making a film. Though I will say, interviewing him, I got to hear, I didn't tape the interview, but he did conversations between Welles and Houston in their voices.
Oh, God. Wow.
And it was like, I regret not having taped that because it was fantastic. But what happened was he, for various reasons, wound up leaving the film after 3 months without his part shot. And so Welles calls up Bogdanovich. He says, "Oh, I'm in terrible trouble. What am I going to do? You know, Rich Little left. We haven't finished his scene. And now I got to start the movie all over again. What am I going to do?" And Peter says, "Why don't I play the part?" And Orson goes, "Oh, my God, would you?" Because I never even thought of that. And he says, "You know, Orson," he said, "you know, it's a young filmmaker who's made three hit films in a row and likes to do impressions." He said, "You never thought of me for the role?" He said, "Well, thank God. Oh, my God, you're going to come here." So Bogdanovich goes, you know, and Welles says, "We'll reshoot your other scenes with somebody else playing that part." And so basically Bogdanovich goes from playing who he is in 1970, in the film in 1970, and in 1974 plays who he has become. And that to me just always, that is the essence of what that film was about, just the way Welles blended life and art, and then, it was kind of art imitating life, and then at some point it became life imitating art. And he and Bogdanovich had a falling out that actually happened in the film a year before he and Bogdanovich had the actual falling out, which to me was just the most surreal thing. Mm.
Josh Karp, the author of Orson Welles' last movie. Josh, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for visiting with us this afternoon. We'll have to do it again
anytime.
Before too long.
I would love it. Thank you so much, Rich.
Josh Karp here on The Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. When we come back, we remember Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone with biographer Nick Parise.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Summertime is best spent chillaxing, and chillaxing happens best with the flavors of summer at The Ground Round. Right now at The Ground Round in Bangor, savor the summer grilled chicken sandwich. It's a tender chicken breast topped with pepper jack cheese and a citrus garlic fruit salsa on a grilled split-top bun served with The Ground Round's house-made pasta. Wash it down with a sangria and round out the meal with the perfect dessert, the strawberry float cake. Seriously, it's amazing. Take your summer chillax to the max with The Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor. GroundRound.com.
60 years ago this fall, one of the most iconic television shows in history made its premiere on the CBS television network, talking, of course, about Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone. Nicholas Parisi has written a wonderful book called Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. And he talked with us just a couple of days ago about The Twilight Zone. Last time we talked to you, we focused on Rod Serling's work before and after The Twilight Zone. But I thought today we'd talk about The Zone itself as we approach the 60th anniversary. And is it safe to say that much of the work that Serling did in the years before 1959 really created the path that led to The Twilight Zone?
Oh, no doubt, in a lot of different ways. I mean, loved science fiction and fantasy long before The Twilight Zone came around. But unfortunately for Rod Serling, he just was never given the opportunity to actually do it on television. He'd done some very small-scale stuff in Cincinnati when he worked there just out of college. He did some science fiction and fantasy, but on a grand scale on the national network, he just wasn't given the opportunity until The Twilight Zone. So he had that background, and then, of course, his desire to address some socially relevant topics in straightforward drama, that was also stymied in doing, you know, in straightforward drama, and he was able to do it in The Twilight Zone in a different way by doing it in a science fiction format. So he was prepared by the time the Twilight Zone came around.
The series premiered on CBS in October of 1959, but is it safe to say that essentially the pilot aired earlier on the old Desilu Playhouse, his story, The Time Element?
I believe so. There's a little bit of debate about that, but the fact is that, yes, the Time Element, which aired on the Desilu Playhouse in 1958, almost a year before The Twilight Zone debuted, was intended to be The Twilight Zone pilot. Serling had submitted it to the network as The Twilight Zone, The Time Element, and the network rejected it as a pilot. They just they didn't think it would work as a pilot. They thought it was a little too out there. The ending was a little too ambiguous, and that the mainstream audience just wouldn't get it. And so it was shelved. But strangely enough, the Desilu Playhouse, which also aired on CBS, they liked the script, and they decided that they would produce it. So it was produced, and it got tremendous reaction from the viewers, and it really did spark CBS into giving The Twilight Zone a better look. Another look, and that's what brought the actual pilot, which was Where Is Everybody, and aired in October of 1959.
And as you point out in the book, Where Is Everybody, in many ways, was a safer choice to be the first episode to try and lure in sponsors.
Yeah, it was, it was one of those happy accidents. You know, if the Time Element had not been rejected, and one other pilot that Rod Serling wrote called The Happy Place, if that had not been rejected, he wouldn't have gotten Where Is Everybody. And it really is the perfect pilot because it really gives us everything that The Twilight Zone is about, but it also does it in a way that's accessible and not too strange for the average sponsor or network executive to get their brain around. It's a plot, and it's even the twist at the end is something that could actually happen. It turns out that this astronaut has just been hallucinating this entire scenario that we've been witnessing, and it could happen. So it was explainable, and it really made the show accessible and was successful in selling the series.
Although, as you point out in the book, the actor in that episode, Earl Holliman, wanted to add another twist at the end to make it a bit more ambiguous.
Yeah, he had an idea. And, you know, I just spoke with Earl Holliman a week or so ago, and he kind of took me to task, actually, for this part of the book because he felt that I made it sound like he really had this idea and he was taking credit for this idea, which he wasn't. But it was a suggestion that he had made, and the suggestion was that, you know, in the episode he plays at the beginning, he doesn't know who he is. I mean, that's the whole plot of the episode, is that he doesn't know who he is and he doesn't know where he is. And it turns out that he is an astronaut who's been undergoing an experiment of isolation to see if an astronaut could handle the isolation that it would take to go to the moon and back again. And he comes out of it and he realizes he's been hallucinating. Well, he had an idea that, hey, you know, what if after I'm done with this and I get out of this isolation booth, I reach into my pocket and I have a page from the phone book that I was looking through in my hallucination, you know, and Serling very smartly said, Earl, that's going to ruin this. I love it, but it's too out there. It's going to be too strange for the people to handle at this point. But when Rod Serling wrote the adaptation of this episode as a short story, he actually added a very, very similar twist where the character, Earl Holliman's character, reaches into his pocket and finds a ticket stub from the movie theater that he had gone to in his hallucination. So the Twilight Zone kind of crept through into reality in that way.
I was looking this morning at the episode list from season one. My gosh, Walking Distance, my favorite of all time, Time Enough at Last, and When the Sky Was Opened, Hitchhiker, Purple Testament, Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, A Stop at Willoughby. Boy, you can make a pretty good case that no television show has ever had a stronger first season.
Oh, I would absolutely make that case. Yeah, I agree with you. The first season of The Twilight Zone is really a sustained excellence from, you know, very, very few valleys in that season from episode one until episode, I think there were 36 episodes in the first season. And you know, television shows don't do that anymore. I mean, nowadays you have a Netflix series that'll have 10 episodes per season, you know. I mean, The Twilight Zone produced 36 episodes and probably 30 of them are great and the other six are okay. You know, it's really, and Rod Serling wrote most of them, you know, and so it's, yeah, it really is pretty amazing.
When you move to season two, the biggest change, and people who are maybe not devout followers and viewers of the show don't realize that Rod Serling didn't appear on camera until that second season.
Right, right. He was the off-camera narrator for the first season. And in the very last episode of the first season, which happened to be written by Richard Matheson, Richard Matheson wrote a scene in which Rod Serling would appear on screen. It was the only time he ever interacted with the characters in an episode, either before or after. And that was the first time he was on screen. And then beginning the second season, he actually appeared as the on-screen narrator at the beginning of each episode.
Some great episodes in season two as well. I think my favorite from that season, well, a couple of them. One is certainly Eye of the Beholder, one of the most famous episodes in a classic Twilight Zone. And a lovely backstory of that, too, with a young actress that would become famous shortly afterward for her work in the Beverly Hillbillies. But we don't actually hear her voice in this episode.
No, Donna Douglas. Well, we do actually hear her voice at the very end. She does get to speak a few lines at the end. And I think she actually sounds enough like the actress under the bandages to pull it off. And she doesn't have to say very much. So it's not as jarring as it could have been if she had to really deliver a lot of lines. But yeah, the voice under the bandages is an actress by the name of Maxine Stewart. And they just felt that she had more of an emotive quality to her voice that was necessary for that particular role. But yes, Eye of the Beholder is to me the quintessential. So that is the episode of, you know, the Martians come down and want to know what the Twilight Zone's all about. That's the one I show them because that has absolutely everything that we have come to expect from a Twilight Zone episode.
And another of my favorites from that second season, and one that became an annual tradition in the Serling household, was Night of the Meek with Art Carney. But Rod Serling wasn't always thrilled with it because it's one of those episodes that they had to shoot on videotape as a cost-cutting measure.
Exactly. Yeah, there were six episodes that were shot on videotape in the second season. And for anybody who, you know, it's one of those frequently asked questions that people see those episodes and they say, what's going on here? Because it just looks completely different from all the other episodes of the series. And the reason was because, yes, it was shot on videotape and it gives a completely different look to the show. And Night of the Meek happened to be one of those. And when the initial, you know, rushes or dailies were coming through with Night of the Meek, Rod Serling was very, very disappointed in it. He thought it was coming out terribly. And even after it aired, I'm not sure that he was all that happy with it. But over time, apparently his opinion changed on it because he did show it to his daughters and their friends every Christmas. And he did much later in his life say that it was one of his favorites. And Art Carney was one of Rod Serling's favorite actors, if not his favorite actor, and he's just tremendous in that episode.
We're talking with Nick Parisi, the author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Season 3 of The Twilight Zone, certainly the toll was beginning to catch up with Rod Serling at this point, but still some wonderful episodes. It's a Good Life, the harrowing episode with the young Billy Mumy, To Serve Man, one of the great episodes of all time. And for me, what I think is the scariest Twilight Zone episode of all, Little Girl Lost.
Oh, really? Wow. Well, that's, yeah. I mean, it's certainly one of the classic episodes. But yeah, it's, I think it's probably scary in a very unnerving way. I mean, especially if you happen to have a daughter. And, you know, you can imagine yourself in this scenario of, you know, the episode, of course, is, you know, a little girl rolls off the bed and rolls through the wall into another dimension. And the father, the parents are, you know, they are trying to grab her back from the other dimension, can't find her, and hearing her cry from another dimension and not being able to reach her. And that, yeah, that is certainly very unnerving. The Twilight Zone, you know, people find it scary, of course. You know, it is a very unnerving, a very creepy show. So you kind of get arguments about what the scariest episode of the series was. I mean, there certainly were plenty to choose from.
Well, yeah, and being a little kid at the time, around the same age, a little bit younger than Billy Mumy, I never wanted to encounter him anywhere after that episode.
I'm sure, and probably even more so when you saw It's a Good Life. I mean, you know, that's probably his most well-known known episode.
Now, going into season 4, the Twilight Zone was in trouble, and they ended up using it as a mid-season replacement. But because of that, the decision was made to go to hour-long episodes. That just didn't quite work out, did it?
It didn't work out, no. But the strange thing about that, or the ironic thing, is a couple of ironies about that. One is that, you know, Rod Serling really envisioned The Twilight Zone as an hour-long series from the beginning. He pitched it as an hour-long series, and he always really wanted an hour-long series. The time element was an hour-long. The first pilots that he wrote, the first pilot, The Happy Place, was intended to be an hour-long. So he always had in mind to do an hour show, and he kind of reluctantly agreed to do it as a half-hour from the get-go, and obviously it worked. But what happened was, even after the second season, believe it or not, the network was starting to say to Rod Serling, hey, maybe we should do this as an hour. They were kind of pushing it a little bit, and Serling still had his, you know, he in the back of his mind, he still wanted that bigger canvas to create. You know, he wanted more room, more time to develop characters, and he obviously didn't do it for the third season. But in between the third and the fourth, when it wasn't renewed immediately, the conversation began again about maybe we'll do this as an hour. And it wasn't, you know, it was kind of a mutual thing between Serling and the network. And they gave it a shot, and it didn't work. For most fans, those hour-long episodes are padded. They just don't quite work as well as the half-hour episodes. And so it was an experiment that didn't quite work out. And then they went back to the half-hour for the last fifth season.
There are still some great moments, though, in that fourth season. From your perspective, what's the best of the hour-long Twilight Zones?
I have two favorites from the fourth season. One is On Thursday We Leave for Home, starring James Whitmore, about a group of colonists from Earth that go to another planet to basically escape the terrible environment on Earth. And they want to come back. They want to come home. They've been away for too long, and they finally realize they want to come home. And it's about this man who's held this community together on another planet for so long, and now all of a sudden they're going to go home and he's going to lose them. And how does he deal with that? It's a great character study, and it's a beautiful piece of writing from Serling. That's certainly one of my favorites. My other favorite is one called The New Exhibit, which Stephen King called this the closest that The Twilight Zone ever got to true horror, just pure horror. It's about a man with a wax museum. He becomes enamored with these wax figures, and the wax museum is going to close, so he takes the wax figures and keeps them in his basement, and they come to life, essentially, and start committing murders. I think that's a really, really good and underrated episode.
And even in season 5, as the show was wrapping up, and we talked with you, there were discussions about a sixth season, but some of the most celebrated episodes of all time in that final year, including William Shatner's unforgettable appearance in Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
Yeah, the fifth season is very strange to when you take it kind of episode by episode. The fifth season has a couple, as you mentioned, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, an undisputed classic of the series. It also had the fifth season also had Little Girl Lost with Talking Tina. I'm sorry, The Living Doll with Talking Tina was in the fifth season.
With Telly Savalas. Oh my word!
Yeah, with Telly Savalas. Yeah. In Praise of Pip is one of my favorites, which, yes, again, Billy Mumy and Jack Klugman. That was the first episode of the fifth season, one of my favorites. So the fifth season has some really, really classic and really good episodes, and then it has the absolute worst of the series. If you were to pick the 10 worst episodes of the series, I think you could probably get 8 of them out of the fifth season, if not all 10. So it really had the biggest gap between really good and really bad in that particular season.
I want to ask you about the bad in a moment, but you mentioned In Praise of Pip, and as I recall, too, that was the first network television show that made any reference to the Vietnam War that at that point was still a conflict with some advisors there.
It was 1964. I mean, way ahead of any other television series. Rod Serling, at least addressed it. He at least mentioned it. And the Jack Klugman character says there isn't even supposed to be a war there. You know, his boy is dying, and there isn't supposed to be a war there. So this was early on in the conflict. As you said, we just had advisors on the ground there, supposedly, and this happened. So yeah, that's a historic episode just for that reason.
All right, now for me, the worst ever is The Bewitching Pool. What's your least favorite episode of all time?
Well, that happens to be the very last episode of the series, The Bewitching Pool, and that, so it really went out on a whimper. And I would agree that that's one of the worst for sure. My least favorite is another fifth season episode called Come Wander With Me.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Oh, horrible. And every time I mention this episode, people ask me to describe it. And I say, it's so bad, I can't even describe it. I can't even really give you the plot of it. It really doesn't even make sense, even in a Twilight Zone sense. It's just awful. That's definitely my least favorite.
Rod Serling went back to actors that he had great respect for and who worked well in the show. I think especially of Burgess Meredith, Jack Klugman, but there were a number of them who did multiple episodes. Who do you think is the quintessential Twilight Zone actor?
It's so hard because the two that come that are certainly in vying for the lead are Burgess Meredith and Jack Klugman. Now they're the two that starred in 4 episodes apiece, and I think they both kind of exhibit these qualities that Serling was always going for. I would give the edge to Jack Klugman. I think Jack Klugman embodies that everyman quality a little bit more than Burgess Meredith did. Burgess Meredith could play kind of the nebbish more than Jack Klugman could, but I think Jack Klugman really is the quintessential actor for the Twilight Zone. And since you mentioned it, we're going to be celebrating the 60th anniversary this year at something called Serling Fest in Binghamton, New York, in Rod Serling's hometown. And right now we're doing a vote online at rodserling.com where people can vote for best actor, best actress, and best episode and all of these things. And it's going to be the first official vote for these things, and we're gonna present the awards at Serling Fest, and be the first official award sanctioned by the Serling Estate and the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation, and it'll be fun to see what people come up with. But Jack Klugman will certainly be one of the choices for best actor.
Well, let's talk more about Serling Fest. It's coming up the first weekend in October, and boy, you've got a stellar cast of presenters. Can you talk a little more about what people will see if they make the trip to Binghamton?
Yeah, I'd love to. It's going to be October 4th, 5th, and 6th, so it's the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The 60th anniversary is October 2nd of 2019 is the 60th anniversary. And we're going to be doing it at 3 different locations. So if you go to rodserling.com, you can get the information on the locations. The main location will be Saturday at the Forum Theater in Binghamton. And we have 11, at my last count, 11 different writers who have written books, substantial books, about Rod Serling or the Twilight Zone or Night Gallery. And so we're going to have presentations, readings, and signings from pretty much all of them. Mark DeWidziak will be there. He wrote Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone. Scott Skelton will be there. He wrote the only Night Gallery reference guide called An After Hours Tour, Rod Serling's Night Gallery. And this year is actually the 50th anniversary of the Night Gallery premiere in 1969. So we'll be celebrating that as well. And so people will be able to see the authors, interact with the authors. We'll have, we're going to have, I mentioned The Happy Place earlier, one of the unproduced pilots. Well, we're going to have a dramatic reading of that script for the first time ever. People will be able to hear that script and performed, performed as a dramatic reading. That'll be on the Friday night. So that's one of the things. We're going to have Twilight Zone trivia and the award ceremony. It's going to be a great time.
Well, we've got it circled on our calendar, and we're hoping to make it out there. It's a long journey, but it would be well worth it to be out there for Serling Fest on the 60th anniversary of the Twilight Zone.
I hope you can make it, Rich. That would be great.
And Nick, always great to talk with you. Thanks again for making time for us, and, well, hope to see you out there in Binghamton this fall.
I hope so. Thanks a lot.
Nick Parisi discussing the Twilight Zone with us here on the Best of Downtown. And I don't know, Carrie, Serling Fest is sounding more and more tempting all the time this fall.
It sure is. I think it would be very interesting to see the people that it would be going to that. It's going to be quite a cross section, I think, of people that are interested in going and talking about the work of Rod Serling.
Yeah, we know Nick will be there putting it together, and Ann Serling, Rod's daughter as well. Should be an awful lot of fun. Also a lot of fun, our conversation with actor and musician Michael McKean. You'll hear it next on the Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Before Dylan, before Cash, there was Guthrie. Penobscot Theater Company presents Woody Guthrie's American Song, Songs and Writings of America's Premier Folk Poet, Woody Guthrie. An exuberant musical celebration of our nation. Bring the whole family to Woody Guthrie's American Song, September 5th to the 29th at Bangor's Historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org.
Wasting my time. You know what I want. You know what I need. Oh, maybe you don't. Do I have to come right flat out and tell you everything? Give me some money.
Oh, nothing like a little Spinal Tap for your morning. Back on the Best of Downtown, we had a chance to talk about Spinal Tap, A Mighty Wind, Laverne and Shirley, Better Call Saul, you name it, with talented actor and musician Michael McKean.
Happy anniversary. What's the appropriate gift for 2,000 shows?
I believe it's wood, but I'm not sure. No, I don't
know. Okay, well, then I got wood for you. Go on.
I'm not sure how to take that. By the way, I'm very jealous of you because I saw the other night you got to see Elvis Costello and Debbie Harry in concert. That looked amazing.
Yep. Well, it was the second time I'd seen Blondie. The first time was exactly 40 years ago at the same venue at the Greek.
Wow.
Elvis, I've seen 1,000 times, and he's just, I think, you know, just such a major artist and such a major dude. It's he's just greater and greater all the time.
Well,
yep, very happy.
You have done so many things that were just huge fans of through the years. We can't cover them all, but I want to go back to the very beginning and see if I have this right. Is it true that you saw with your dad the British actor Stanley Holloway on stage, and that's what inspired you to go into this profession?
That is very, very true. I remember the moment thinking that what a great job this is. I mean, he gets up there, he's having the time of his life. He's making all these other people happy, and they pay him. So I thought, yeah, that looks like a, you know, I knew that such an occupation existed, I suppose, but this was just kind of being there. It was my first Broadway show, really. I'd seen a few musicals in the sticks, but this was my first big show, and it was such a lovely show, and I loved all those music hall songs. So I thought maybe I'd give that a shot. And so now it's about 60-something years later, and I'm still wondering if it was a good idea, but here I am.
And your parents wanted you to have a plan B, and you had a rock-solid one, right?
Sure. I can also play the guitar a little bit.
What could go wrong?
That did lead, yes. I mean, it was like, you know, the sex might lead to dancing kind of thing. You know, performing led to wanting to learn the guitar, which led to songwriting, none of which you can cash in at a window. Fortunately, I've always done exactly what I wanted to do and what I love. And I think I got a huge break there. And it's been a very nice life so far.
And speaking of music, people may not know, you were, I guess with an asterisk, you were part of a really talented 60s band that had a couple of big hits before you arrived. Can you talk about your time with Left Banc?
Well, I'm kind of a numbered footnote to an asterisk, really. What happened was the band made this single, Walk Away Renee. Nothing happened. They had a flip side that got a little play. No, not much. Of course, this is in the late 60s. This was actually the middle 60s. And the charts were just a different thing then. But the band broke up. They went their separate ways. Everybody had a big fight. I had nothing to do with it. I wasn't there. But then the record started happening, and it became an actual hit. Got to like number three somewhere. And so they put a band together again. And their original drummer was a friend of mine. He says, come on and play the guitar. So I rehearsed with them for 3 months. And we got ready to get out there on the road, and then the band broke up again because the keyboard player and his father, who was also our manager, had a huge fight. And it's just, you know, it was one of those internecine things that had something to do with anything else. But I, you know, I grabbed my guitar and my pretty suits, and I hit the road and went back to school. That's the whole story.
School was Carnegie Mellon, or as my wife's uncle, who went there as well, calls it Carnegie, which is correct.
Well, at the time, it was Carnegie Tech. Mm. It was before the Mellon money, yeah. And but actually, this was, I went back to school. I went back to NYU for a couple of years.
Right. Now, it was at Carnegie that you met up with David Lander, became friends, and it was actually there that you developed the characters of Lenny and Squiggy.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. David and I met while painting a chair. They made all the freshman acting students do crew work. So we were painting a chair together, and this strange little man, also an 18-year-old person like me, and we just had a great rapport. His favorite Broadway show of all time was How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, one of the co-stars of which was a guy named Rudy Valley, and my father had written ghostwritten his autobiography, so we had a lot to talk about. And he just turned out to be one of those guys. You know, you meet him occasionally, meet people occasionally that you go, well, we were sort of made for each other, weren't we? You know? And when those things happen, you got to listen because someone's sending the messages.
Yeah, and he went to L.A. and then got in touch with you. And as a writer, he even said, I'm doing a little radio thing. You can do some of that. We can work together.
Right. The credibility gap, yeah. Mm. I remember David calling me up and telling me two things. I just got married. And I said, oh, congratulations. And also, you got to come out here because we're trying to find somebody to replace this guy we're trying to get rid of. the credibility gap was a satirical news program. Very funny. So I did that. I made a little money doing a children's record. And so I took that cash and I went out to L.A., and I figured I'd stay for a month or so, and I'm still here.
How did you meet up with Penny Marshall and Rob Reiner?
Well, they were friends of David. David had actually had appeared in a play directed by Rob Reiner, written by Phil Mishkin. And you know, they knew each other. They were friends. I think they roomed together briefly. All those guys did. Rob and Penny, when they were early married, you know, we used to see them around at David's house or clubs when we would do a gig. They would come and see us. So, you know, Penny was somebody I just kind of knew peripherally. I knew her from TV. I thought she was brilliantly funny. And so the middle 70s, you know, 1975, 76, that's when we started working together. And you probably know the rest. You seem to know everything else.
We're talking with Michael McKean on Downtown. Well, she offered...
You remember my Hulu password?
I have.
As long as you know everything else about me, the one thing I can't.
I'm not going to say it on the air. I do know
okay.
it clearly.
Yeah, text me.
So she reached out to you and said, "Oh, we got a writing opportunity for you here, and maybe you can work in those two characters of yours and David's." And you did that with all deliberate speed, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we did with the very first episode, in fact. You know, they said, look, well, maybe you guys could be in the scene. So we went into the scene and said, well, can we write what we say? And they said, well, you're writers, go ahead. And so we wrote a little bit of it and, it was fine. It was enough that it established the characters. It's funny. They're showing those now on Logo.
Right.
You know, and I happened to catch one the other day and it's just so interesting because some of them I haven't seen in literally 40 years. So it's because you look at that stuff and you go, I remember exactly what went on every moment. And it's true. I have that kind of brain. Useless.
Well, of course, the show became an enormous hit on the air for several seasons. And then shortly after that, early 80s, Spinal Tap. And
right.
I have to think when you guys were working on this, could you have had any idea of the lasting impact? The fact that nearly four decades later, there are still generations of people who I'm sure approach you in airports and quote lines from the film.
Yes, but only in airports, strangely enough. No, that's not true. You're absolutely right. We just wanted to make it funny. And the only way we knew how to do it was by kind of keeping each, it was the four of us, by keeping ourselves honest about what makes each other laugh. Because we all got the joke. And we all knew what was extraneous to the joke, and we all knew what was spot on to the joke. The joke being the reality of this false thing that we're telling. And we just we kind of had each other. You know, if I made the other guys like, if the scenes only work if we're all on the same page, and we just got real lucky and we worked real hard, and we took a while, but we got it right.
Is that sort of trust between the actors what makes ensemble work so well for you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, listen, I've always been a team player as far as that goes. You know, I love being involved in stuff no matter kind of what level I'm on. And I always have because it's kind of a nice feeling. It's at its most distinct, I think, in a show. I've been doing a lot of theater in the last 20 years, and there's nothing like that. It really is like, well, this is it. They're your family now. Or they're like the small town you've moved to. Mm. You all know each other's business, and you all have this weird and amazing job to do eight times a week. It's just, for me, it's still thrilling.
Yeah, you mentioned the stage work, and you've done so many wonderful plays from Hairspray to Superior Donuts, Little Foxes, all the way with our friend Bryan Cranston. Also, I found this out doing a little research here. About 20 years ago, I did one of the strangest productions of Cymbeline ever, and I was directed by a woman named Kate Powers that I think you know.
Oh, absolutely. She's awesome. She's one of my heroes, really.
Yeah, and she brought you to Sing Sing, right?
He did, yes. Sing Sing did a production of Superior Donuts, which I had done on Broadway, and at Steppenwolf before that. And she said she was directing that, and she wanted to know if I wanted to meet the cast. And I said, of course. So I went up and had a very, very interesting evening there. And we've stayed in touch since then, and we've kind of, you know, we're pals because I think we respect each other. And she's really one of those real heroic people that you've run into. Some of them are nurses. Some of them are theater directors.
Sure. The movies you've done with Christopher Guest and with Harry, they're so brilliant. A Mighty Wind, that had to be fulfilling on so many different levels. Winning the Grammy, of course, but getting the Oscar nomination, but getting it with your wife, Annette. How cool was that?
It was very cool. It was something that just kind of came upon us. It was right after 9/11, and we were driving, because the planes were all grounded, we were driving back to Vancouver, where my wife was working on Smallville. So on this drive, we started writing songs, and they kept kind of, you know, Chris was already starting his work on Mighty Wind, and so they all seemed to be kind of gravitating toward that feel. So we started, we wrote two songs right off the top and wrote a couple more that were not used. You know, and wrote one more with C.J. Vanston, and I wrote with everybody else. But it was really kind of like, oh, okay, here we are early in our relationship. We've been married for 2 years at this point. And it's like this, we have this too. And so it was very nice kind of, it was almost like getting a pat on the back for having good instincts. You know, there was no way I could know that she'd be really fun to write songs with, but here we are. So.
And then to have it be that beautiful moment in a uproariously funny movie, but a very poignant moment between Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah, yeah, it's lovely. Chris made that song an actor in the show, and that was kind of like why I got some notice.
Let's talk about Better Call Saul, which is absolutely my favorite television show. We've had your castmate, Patrick Fabian, on the program. Had him also do his killer Jonathan Banks impression.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding, yeah. Yeah, you know what? I'll tell you, though, and this doesn't work for radio, the best Jonathan Banks impressions don't have any words.
Oh, you're right.
I have seen him shorten the life of a waiter from 20 yards. It's pretty astounding.
Well, we talked about ensembles and the group of actors that you have in Better Call Saul, and then couple that with the brilliant writing and direction. It just doesn't get any better.
No, it was a pot of jam I fell into, and I'm glad it worked out the way it did. Vince Gilligan, I've worked with Vince on X-Files, and every time he had something cooking, he would call me up. You know, I was doing All the Way with Brian, and Brian was kind of filling me in on, yeah, they're talking about stuff over there, and Better Call Saul, it's going to be really good, and you should do this. And so I kind of felt I had a friend in court anyway, along with Vince.
Well,
and it turned out good.
Yeah, it sure did. And man, I've always felt like sometimes the best acting is done without a word of dialogue being spoken. And I think of the incredible, powerful work everybody did, but you in particular in the courtroom scene, my word.
Oh, thanks. Well, I had a lot to say in that one too. It was, it was one of those things. It was, the director called me up and said, oh, hi, I'm Dan Sackheim, and, I'm going to direct. Good. He says, have you read the script yet? I said, no, not yet. A long sigh, and he said, okay, here's how I think we're going to have to do this. Because it was one of those things where you want to get it all in one swallow if it's going to really, really work. So I said, look, you know, I'll work on it. I'll get it no matter what it is. And it's a big scene, but it was really never not fun, mainly because of the company and the feel of the place. It was so, you know, by this time, I'd loved everybody there, and they seemed to tolerate me, and you know, I had your Ray Seahorn on the set. I had the whole gang there. So it was pretty nice. And, of course, Mr. Odenkirk. Not a bad guy to go to.
Yeah, he's okay, too. Yeah.
He's awesome. Yeah.
And Chuck, obviously, when you play a character, you have to believe in what they're doing. And I know some people have said, well, he's not a sympathetic character. Well, but of course he is from your perspective. And I feel like his actions toward Jimmy are completely justified because of Jimmy's lack of ethics in the profession that Chuck loves so much, and even the allusion to the role that Chuck played in raising Jimmy. And I mean, that scene when he talks about the book that parents read, and you correct him and say, you know, I read that book to you.
Yeah. Well, it's a very complicated relationship. All brothers are probably complicated. Yeah.
I think you said it all.
Will we see, maybe you can't let the cat out of the bag either way, will we see more flashbacks with Chuck in the coming season?
The cat stays discreetly in the bag, I'm afraid.
I thought that would be the case.
Yeah.
Another work that you just had out was Good Omens on Amazon.
Yeah.
That was a great, and your role of Sergeant Shadwell was just great. I read a Thank description you. That you gave of his accent as cranky old Scotspeak, and in the book it's described as an indeterminate regional accent that wandered
right.
around a bit. So what was that process for you to get Shadwell's accent to the point where you and Neil Gaiman wanted it to be for the show?
When he first approached me about the role, he says, "How's your Scottish accent?" I said, "Well, I'll give it a shot." And he said, "Actually, this is," and I had read the book, and he said, "Do you remember anything about?" And I didn't remember Shadwell's accent thing, but he said in the book it was he goes all over the British Isles. He's just a wanderer. He says, "Well, I don't think we can do this because it just looks like the actor's looking around for the accent." In other words, there's no narrator in the, you know, who would point this out. It would be in the dialogue, but he decided not to do that. It's just like a real general kind of, you know, work on a Scottish accent and we'll go from there. So I had a lot of Scottish people on the set, of course, Doug McKinnon and David Tennant. And I would ask them for, you know, help and edification and Doug had a tendency to go, "Don't worry about it. You know, Shadwell's from everywhere. Don't try and nail it down." And, you know, you can't really do that. I when I was a kid, if I wanted to do an Irish accent, I'd just pretend that I was Barry Fitzgerald. I'd just do a Barry Fitzgerald accent. And I could have done, there's a guy, a very funny Scottish comic named Frankie Boyle. And I listened to a lot of him, and I could just do Frankie Boyle, but it would have been 100% wrong for the character.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had to, you know, stay honest to who I thought he was. And you know, the accent is a mess, but hey, we got through it. We all survived. That's what matters.
We're talking with Michael McKean. Have to ask you about Celebrity Jeopardy that you won. What was the biggest challenge or the toughest part of that whole scenario?
Well, one very tough thing took care of itself when Andy Richter took himself out of the contest. To go on the road with Conan.
Right.
Nobody would have beaten him. I wouldn't have had a shot with him at all. And the other one was on the day was actually Jane Curtin and Cheech Marin were both monsters, really fast on the buzzer and really smart. And it was only through a fluke that I'd made enough the previous day, and Cheech beat me the second game, but still I hadn't, you know, you added the two together and I came out the winner. But it was really fun and really, you had to concentrate.
I love a Food Fact or Fiction. Will there be a fourth season of that?
There has been a fourth season.
Well, there was. Was that the fourth?
Yeah, that was the fourth. And I think we're still kind of waiting to hear. They might have enough. You know, it's very popular, apparently. People like to watch them over and over again, which I think is great. It's on the Cooking Channel, but I think some of the reruns are also on the Food Channel. It just flail around. You can find Food Fact or Fiction. It's really fun. And you can actually learn stuff that's almost useless, but, you know, you pull it out at a cocktail party and you get a free drink.
Right, no knowledge.
For sure at a party, anyway.
No such thing as useless knowledge. I understand you've got some projects in the can. Anything you can share with us?
Yeah, I'm in the next season of Grace and Frankie. Did a stretch there. There is a show called Breeders, which I shot in the UK with Martin Freeman and the great Daisy Haggard. And those are upcoming. That's going to be on FX here. Yeah. I did a little film with my friend Kelly Oxford, which could be really, really good. And I'm going to take a little break now, and I might have something going in November, but I'm going to go hang with my wife. She's shooting a show up in Vancouver pretty soon, and so I'm going to go be her fancy man.
Very nice. Well, I meant to mention, too, loved your appearance on The Good Place. We've had Will Jackson Harper on the show a couple times. That was great.
I did All the Way with Will Harper.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. He's my hero, man. He's great. And just all my girlfriends and my wife and my daughters all said, after they saw All the Way, they said, "Oh, that was great. It's just, Brian was great. Who's that guy?" Yeah, he's cute, isn't he? But he's an amazing actor. He's got great range, and I think it's nice that people know who he is.
Absolutely. Well, Michael, it's a real treat for us. We've been fans of your work for so long. Thank you so much for making time for us, and we wish you and Annette continued success and good health.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate it. And have a great congratulations again on number 2,000, and do a couple thousand more, and then call me back.
I'll do it again. Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Rich.
Michael McKean, who joined us for show number 2,000 recently. What a fun time that was. Talking with him. We'll do that again down the road. I don't think we'll have to wait 2,000 more shows.
No, I don't think so. At least hopefully that was a joke on his part at the end, because there's so much more to talk to him about.
He was great. Michael McKean, thanks to him. Josh Karp, Nick Parisi as well. Thanks to you for making us a part of your Sunday morning. We've got a great week of guests coming up. My goodness. Tomorrow on the program, actor David Marciano from the hit series Bosch will join us. Chad Finn from the Boston Globe. Mike Lowe, Portland Press Herald, talking Black Bear football. Alan Adams of the Main Edge. And among the highlights this week, Anson Williams, Patsy Weber himself from Happy Days, actress and comedian Jerry Jewell from Deadwood, actor Jerry O'Donnell, also in Bosch, and one of those character guys that's in a million things. The directors of the wonderful new Linda Ronstadt documentary, The Sound of My Voice, and legendary director Peter Bogdanovich. All coming up this week on Downtown. We look forward to convening tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll catch you next time right here on Z62. You're gonna be